Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This is Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa Podcast. One of the downsides of political idolatry is the possibility that your hero becomes a repugnant sleaze. For the legions of Andrew Cuomo fans who lionized the New York governor for his handling of COVID-19, they must now eat the proverbial crow as their fearless hero turned out to be a peerless zero with a penchant for groping and harassing his female aides. Yesterday, he resigned from office.
I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing. And therefore, that's what I'll do. Because I work for you. And doing the right thing is doing the right thing for you. Because as we say, it's not about me. It's about we.
But let's rewind for a moment to the spring of 2020, when Cuomo was riding high. While President Donald J. Trump was downplaying the virus, New York City had become ground zero for the pandemic. Sirens blared throughout the day and night as the city resembled a morgue. If Trump was out to lunch or simply being his incompetent self, Cuomo was his polar opposite, prepared, empathetic, and ready for action. With his calming demeanor, bad jokes, and just the facts presentations, he became America's dad. His daily briefings became appointment viewing for people all over the country at a time when fear, anxiety, isolation, and grief were mounting.
I started my tomato sauce before I left. We're going to go back. We're going to sit at the table, have our spaghetti and meatballs on Sunday. And I know what I'm going to talk to them about.
I was part of his cheering section, as were countless others, and Cuomo's approval rating and public profile had soared. We placed in him everything that we could not find in Donald Trump. He became a vessel for our hopes and dreams for what was possible from a strong, decisive, and progressive leader. There were whispers of Cuomo joining the presidential ticket, and many of us wished it was him and not Biden that we were going to be nominating.
David, we're standing by for Governor Cuomo's press conference, his daily briefing. How would you contrast Cuomo and President Trump's handling of the crisis?
Truth versus mendacity.
Governor Cuomo out there day after day after day, everything Trump isn't, honest, direct, brave.
Real leadership of the kind the President of the United States should have provided.
Governor Cuomo is clearly living in a totally different reality, the actual one, than the President of the United States.
Governor Cuomo has become a national leader.
For a lot of people, Andrew Cuomo has become the leader of the Democratic Party.
He is conveying incredible strength.
You spoke to National Guard troops today in a stirring speech that, if I wasn't listening carefully, I thought you were sending soldiers off to war.
This has been a remarkable show of leadership by Governor Cuomo in recent days. He's providing hope, but not false hope.
Governor Cuomo, no. I think, is one of the heroes on the front lines.
With all of this adulation that you're getting for doing your job, are you thinking about running for president?
But such is the power of Donald Trump and the wave of discontent he created, a blinding force field where we became inured to Cuomo's flaws because we wanted him. No, we needed him to be the answer to this awful cancer in the White House.
Now says his own health officials are lying about the virus. His own CDC health officials are lying about the virus. Well, if the president is telling the truth, you know what he should do? He should fire them. Someone is clearly lying. to the American people. And people are dying because of it. Trump's COVID scandal makes what Nixon did at Watergate look innocent.
Unfortunately, like cancer, sometimes the cure is worse than the disease. And Cuomo, while certainly no Donald Trump, revealed himself to be just as flawed and broken as the man he was lambasting on a daily basis from his COVID bully pulpit. It turns out his handling of COVID was suspect and his data manipulated to make himself look better. And we now know America's dad was a midnight creeper of the worst kind, seeking out vulnerable young women in his orbit. His behavior is inexcusable and he has rightly resigned.
In my mind, I've never crossed the line with anyone. But I didn't realize the extent to which the line has been redrawn. There are generational and cultural shifts that I just didn't fully appreciate. And I should have. No excuses.
Unfortunately, our love for Andrew Cuomo has been awkwardly memorialized in the wave of hero worship that broke in his wake. There were professed crushes from mainstream magazines, and the New Yorker recently devoted column inches to a deconstruction of the so-called Cuomo-sexual.
Say on behalf of just me, but my family, but New Yorkers, bigger than that, the world, thank you for your leadership.
Can I say that I am a Cuomo-sexual?
Everyone should be a Cuomo-sexual in that way.
It asks how we could watch the governor's narcissism, bullying, and hackneyed paternalism and have found those qualities attractive. That what we found repulsive in Trump because it was coming from the right, we crave from Cuomo, who offered a kind of alternative universe ruled by facts and competent bureaucrats. It was a fantasy for how we wished the government would run. But it was nonetheless a fucking fantasy.
This morning, growing fallout for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and his administration over withholding COVID death toll numbers in nursing homes. His top aide, Melissa DeRosa, telling Democratic lawmakers this week on a private call, "We froze, concerned that the information was going to be used against us."
Randy Rainbow, the YouTube political satirist, popularized the term in a knowing but now cringe-inducing peen to the governor. Merchandise proliferated with taglines like, "I identify as a Cuomo-sexual," and for a while, it became big business.
If we're on Earth for what it's worth, I hope they make you king. You run my state while I gain weight with grace and dignity. Oh, please be my dad. Oh, Andy.
And when you are united, there is nothing you can't do.
He became his own cause célèbre, adopted by The Daily Show's Trevor Noah and celebrities like Jimmy Fallon and Ellen DeGeneres, who used the term to express their love for the governor just as his popularity was peaking.
The term Cuomo-sexual refers to Andrew and his brother, CNN anchor Chris Cuomo's adoring new fans.
There's a group of women who came out and they said, We're falling in love with Cuomo. And I said, well, yeah, everyone should be a Cuomo-sexual in that way.
I don't miss a press conference. When Cuomo's on, I'm like, got to go see my celebrity crush right now. Sorry.
These feelings are perfectly natural. Many Americans experience moments of being at least Andrew curious, if not fully Cuomo-sexual.
Andrew and Chris have captured many hearts with their on-air sparring over the last few weeks amid the coronavirus pandemic.
On the popular and often feminist blogging site Jezebel, a writer professed her literal crush on Cuomo, likening it to Stockholm Syndrome. Cuomo isn't holding me hostage so much as coronavirus is, but he is the only one telling me what to do, where I can and cannot go anywhere, who I can and cannot see everyone, who I cannot and cannot listen to, President Trump, Bill de Blasio, what I can and cannot eat, anything but pasta.
Andrew Cuomo, we love him 'cause he does his job. Andrew Cuomo, competence really turns us on.
And it wasn't just its writer. Even the most supposedly balanced outlets let themselves crush on Cuomo. Ben Smith, the New York Times media columnist, wrote a column headlined, "Andrew Cuomo is the control freak we all need right now." Politico ran a profile on him that dug into his past and present presidential aspirations. News reports mooned over the governor, proclaiming the moment to be his finest hour.
Governor Andrew Cuomo, welcome to the Daily Social Distancing Show.
Pleasure to be with you. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you very much. I think everyone is a big fan of yours right now because more than ever during this pandemic, people have sought out leaders who communicate effectively and seem to know what they're trying to do. Nobody has all the answers about coronavirus, but people look for leaders who know what they would like to do.
The New Yorker's Lizzie Whitcomb writes that the governor presented himself as an alternative to Trump. And New Yorkers embraced the comparison, swooning over Cuomo's Queens accent and his tough guy shtick. "Forget bodyguards," he said of Trump. "He'd better have an army if he thinks he's going to walk down the streets in New York." We basked in his awkward displays of affection, looking into a camera and telling New Yorkers, "I miss you. I love you. I am thinking about you." Smiled at his on-screen banter with his brother Chris, the muscle-bound CNN anchor, and giggled at his dad's jokes about serving spaghetti and meatballs to his adult daughters and a boyfriend.
Advice to fathers, the answer on what you think of the boyfriend is always, "I like the boyfriend," always. Because there's only two options. Either you like the boyfriend, in which case you say, "I like the boyfriend," or you don't like the boyfriend. But you can never say you don't like the boyfriend.
According to the New York Times, Lingua Franca, a fashion brand known for activist slogans, sold cashmere sweaters with Cuomo Sexual and Cuomo for President hand-embroidered on them for $400. And Betches, a media company geared toward millennial women, sold a t-shirt emblazoned with the phrase. For those few weirdos still enamored with Cuomo, merchandise still abounds on sites like Etsy, where one can purchase all manner of now discounted Cuomo ephemera.
But he bought like 15 Cuomo Sexual mugs, and he keeps tweeting like, "I have 1,100 Cuomo Sexual mugs. Please, somebody take these off my hands. I need to sell them. I have a family."
The point, though, is to look at our own craven need to worship so-called strongmen. The right is having a field day with this at the moment, gleefully stomping on Cuomo's grave and reminding us of our own hypocrisy, even as their own people continue to tear apart American democracy and propagate all manner of misinformation around COVID-19.
There's Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, who's faced multiple allegations that he turned a blind eye to sexual abuse by the Ohio State wrestling team physician while Jordan was the assistant coach. And yet Republicans continue to stand by him, even choosing him to be their ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida is currently under investigation by the Department of Justice over whether he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and paid for her to travel with him. Only one of his Republican colleagues, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, has called on him to resign, and Gaetz remains in office and on his committees.
What was it about the moment in time that made us turn to Cuomo in such slavish fashion? For many of us, reading the AG's report and listening to the governor's cynical denials spurs a kind of embarrassed clarity, similar to the feeling one experiences after running into an old ex. How could we have witnessed these same qualities? In Cuomo's case, the narcissism, the bullying, the hackneyed paternalism. And find them attractive, writes Whitcomb in the New Yorker. It also provides potential answers when we wonder how people can continue to fall for Donald Trump's bullshit. So let's face it, authoritarianism is attractive when it stands in defiance of things you profoundly hate. When you feel helpless and frightened and the world appears to be out of control, we look to our leaders to save us. "Look for the helpers," said Mr. Rogers. But it also creates an atmosphere where strength, or the projection of strength, looks attractive to the alternative. This is how authoritarianism rears its head. It looks for a vacuum where chaos reigns and offers total control.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. when the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine. That's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling.
And now for the main event. My next guest on Mea Culpa is Ryan Grimm, currently the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of The Intercept, known for its outstanding reporting on the intelligence community and issues of national security. Prior to his joining The Intercept, Grimm held the same position at the Huffington Post, where he twice led reporting teams that were Pulitzer finalists for their work. His own reporting was the first to blow the whistle on Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh, reporting on the letter Dianne Feinstein received from Christine Blasey Ford, accusing Kavanaugh of assault. He is also a political commentator for the Young Turks and appears frequently as a guest on the Majority Report with Sam Sater and Rising with Crystalyn Sager. His writings have appeared in several publications, including Rolling Stones, The Washington Post, and Politico. Grimm is also the author of This Is Your Country on Drugs and We've Got People. A known progressive fighter, Grimm is not afraid to mix it up. He joins me today on Mea Culpa in the wake of Andrew Cuomo's resignation to discuss the governor, as well as Tom Barrack, Jared Kushner, and Trump's corruption in the Emirates, plus so much more. So let's listen now to that conversation. I want to start today with a question about Andrew Cuomo and Letitia James.
Mm-hmm.
Their relationship is longer and more complicated than people realize. Can you tell my listeners what you know about their shared history and the deal Cuomo pushed on James?
Oh, yeah, boy. Is it Shakespearean or Greek or something? It's a hell of a story. You know, in 2003, when she first ran for city council, she ran on the ticket of the Working Families Party. You know, WFP can line up on the same ballot as Democrats in a kind of fusion process. But she said, no, I'm WFP and WFP only. And she won. And it was the first time the WFP had ever elected somebody on their own to city council. And it kind of really shook up, you know, New York politics. So she spent the next, you know, decade as this kind of independent progressive. She becomes a public advocate. And then when Eric Schneiderman is pushed, you know, resigns from office with that Me Too scandal, she's floated in 2018 as a likely successor. But she didn't have a whole lot of big money connections because she'd been such a grassroots candidate. And so Andrew Cuomo, who had long hated the Working Families Party, but hated them even more because they had recently endorsed Cynthia Nixon against him. He goes to Tish James and says, look, I will endorse you and I will open up my fundraising network to you. But there is one condition. And the condition is you must renounce the endorsement of the Working Families Party. And there's no practical or strategic or tactical reason for her to do that on her own. Like because WFP endorses you, you take the endorsement. You know, it's not there's no harm, like it's in it and it's a positive for you. So she's faced with this choice. I have to either reject Andrew Cuomo and have him, you know, turn him into an eternal enemy, or I accept Andrew Cuomo's support. I get access to all of that money, but I have to betray the very people, you know, who I first came into power with. And she ended up taking the deal. And so Cuomo endorsed her, held a, you know, fundraiser for her. WFP actually endorsed her anyway, which is kind of sad and poignant in a weird way. But she rejected their endorsement. She goes on, she wins, but then not long after she wins, you know, now she's attorney general, and she released the investigation into the nursing home scandal that really precipitated his descent. You know, the sexual harassment scandal looks like it could be the nail in his coffin, but you know, the real, you know, the first scratch in his armor was that nursing home scandal. And so then Cuomo did everything he could to not kick the sexual harassment investigation over to Tish James. He kept trying to give it to this judge that he had appointed to multiple different positions throughout her career. But that that didn't work. Public pressure forced him to give it to James. And now James had the opportunity to prove her independence after making that deal with the devil. And we all saw the result of it this week.
Yeah, that we did. You know, one of the things that I saw is also Tish James put out a lot of feelers that if in fact that Cuomo does not resign or whether he's impeached, she's going to run for the office in 2022. Yeah. Have you seen that as well?
I mean, people have talked about that, and she's certainly a very credible. She's certainly one of the most credible candidates. I know Jumaane Williams has, you know, he didn't run for mayor. And when people would ask him why, he said he had his eye on statewide office, and he already ran for lieutenant governor. So it's unlikely to be that one. So that would be two WFP people kind of competing. Yes, I mean, I think both of them have their eye on the governor's mansion at some point.
What do you think would end up happening? I mean, what's your opinion? If in fact that Tish James primaries Andrew Cuomo, I mean, right now he could not be at his weakest. He may legitimately be at the weakest he's ever been, regardless of the office that he was running for. If in fact, because Tish James right now is actually at her most popular, what do you think ends up happening? Because you're right. There is big money, and I mean really big money, behind Andrew Cuomo. I mean, my understanding, some of his biggest donors, you have Recklers, which is Rex and Company. You have Cablevision, Durst, you know, the Durst Corporation, Fisher Brothers. I mean, these are big, big companies, and they've given hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, to Cuomo year after year after year. She doesn't have that big money guarantee like he does. What do you think ends up happening?
She didn't have it in 2018 because she wasn't a national figure. And also Zephyr Teachout was running for attorney general, and she kind of had the national grassroots fundraising base. I think if she ran for governor and Cuomo didn't step aside, she could just press a button and would raise millions from people around the country who would just wanted to see Cuomo get a comeuppance. So I think she would probably even outraise Cuomo because, you know, a lot of Cuomo's money, as you know, is fear money. You have to pay him or else you're going to pay, you know, dearly down the road. And so if he doesn't have the same power, then he doesn't have the same ability to, you know, inflict fear on people. And so then he's going to have trouble raising money, you know, from those same sources. You know, he might come to them and be like, look, you've been giving me money for 20, 30 years. And they've been, well, times have changed. Some of them are going to be loyal and some of them are going to pay just on the off chance that he does hold on and they don't want to be on his bad side. But a lot of them are going to say, no, you're on your own now, bud.
There's such a similarity between Cuomo and Trump. First of all, like Trump, Cuomo is a bully. You know, what's interesting is the fact that while I was at Otisville, one of Cuomo's chiefs of staff, one of his top dogs, was there with me. And we used to sit and compare stories about the similarities between the Trumps and the Cuomos. Obviously, well-known father, significant, money. Now, the Cuomos, of course, never had the money that Fred Trump had, but they had the power, which was something that Fred Trump didn't have. He had the money, and his money bought him power, whereas Cuomo had the power, which sort of gave them the lifestyle right. that they became accustomed to. They're both bullies. They're both, narcissists. They're with hubris and egos. They're both womenizers. It's amazing the similarities that exist between the two. And I believe it's those similarities, especially since Trump has brought to the forefront, what are there, like 20 women that are accusing him of sexual misconduct? Now you have Cuomo. There are 11 women with sexual misconduct. Why do you think that there's such a similarity between these two characters? And how do you think that ends up playing for Cuomo? Is that the sort of Vulcan death touch to his political career?
Well, I think in some ways, New York politics and kind of New York, and you know this world better than I do, but, you know, New York selects at the very top for some of those qualities and some of those traits. You know, you can bully your way through and muscle your way through with enough money, enough power, enough connections. And I think actually Democratic voters, you know, got understood that that Cuomo was very much like Trump, but they overlooked, they didn't just overlook it. In some ways, they almost liked it. And they would say, well, he's our Trump. You know, we need a Trump to take on a Trump, because, you know, Democratic voters are always are so tired of some of their leaders kind of seeming meek on television. You know, for years, the two spokespeople out of Congress for Democrats were Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, who are not instilling, you know, fear in anybody, even if they're both like very adept kind of parliamentary tacticians in D.C. You know, on television, they're not a Trump and they're not a Cuomo. And so so I think Democratic voters were willing to overlook all sorts of problems to say that, OK, finally, we have somebody that can punch back at Trump.
Yeah, except New York, while we do like somebody with sharp elbows, one of the things that New York has definitely shown is that we don't fuck around when it comes to these sexual misconducts, these Me Too issues. Elliot Spitzer certainly got no pass from New Yorkers for his actions. Schneiderman, yeah,
he was gone the same day.
Yeah, he walked quickly in order to try to save his name and his reputation. And then Anthony Weiner, while not, of course, at that height of a level, but guaranteed he would have been the mayor, right? So, you know, one thing about New Yorkers is we don't fuck around when it comes to this Me Too stuff, right? This is sort of like the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak.
I think that's right. And, you know, so much of Cuomo's power was built around this mystique of Cuomo. Yeah, that if you cross him, you know, your career is over. And, you know, if you rule by fear, then the second that people are no longer afraid of you, all your power evaporates. And people are no longer afraid of Cuomo. And so what does he have left without that?
Very little. Hi, folks. Michael Cohen here, and we've got an amazing sponsor for this episode, The Jordan Harbinger Show. Things can get pretty intense discussing American politics, so if you need a break from the news cycle and want to hear incredible storytelling that is both fascinating and actionable, check out the August 5th episode with neuroscientist Douglas Fields, who discusses the rage circuit in our brain and why we snap. Or the fascinating interview with journalist Nicole Perlroth from August 2nd discussing the new cyber arms race. The show covers such a wide range of topics through weekly interviews with heavy-hitting guests. And there are a ton of episodes you'll find interesting since you're a fan of this show, like the July 6th interview with master pickpocket Bob Arno on how he spots a mark. There's an episode for everyone, though, no matter what you're into. The show covers stories like how a professional art forger made millions of dollars while being chased by the feds and the mafia. Jordan's also done an episode on how to deal with corrupt and crooked bosses, addiction, brain chemistry, and so much more. The podcast covers a lot, but one constant is his ability to pull useful pieces of advice from his guests. I promise you, you'll find something useful that you can apply to your own life, whether it's an actionable routine change that boosts your productivity or just a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. We really enjoy the show, and we think you will as well. So search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, one of the more troubling aspects of this Cuomo scandal is the silence coming from those in the media and certain Democrats who engaged in gratuitous hero worship of Cuomo in May of 2020. Now, cable news needed a counterweight to Trump and found the hardworking, talkative Cuomo camera ready to fill that role. Then the scandal hit and collective fucking amnesia. All of a sudden, everybody forgets, right? Should we not hold our leaders to a higher standard than Trump and the right so that we can at least maintain the moral high ground by enforcing the law and calling out bad behavior?
Yeah, absolutely. And at least, you know, I'll give credit to Biden and Pelosi and some others who, you know, quickly called on him to resign, and credit to a lot of the state assembly members in New York who are not just called on him to resign, but, you know, are working up impeachment articles and Judiciary Committee hearing on Monday, and they're pushing forward. But right, you know, I saw a report somewhere that Chris Cuomo's ratings went up by like 100,000 viewers the day that the report came out, because people were kind of curious to see if he was going to say anything about it, given that he'd done the Cuomo Brothers show for so long. And the hour went by without a single mention of it. That in particular was one of the more brazen ethical breaches I think that the media has been part of in modern memory, really. It was just absolutely extraordinary to have a guy just interviewing his brother, doing, you know, the kind of interviews you would expect of if you were interviewing your brother. And then when the scandal hits, then it's all of a sudden, oh, well, there's a conflict of interest. I can't interview my brother. Well, weren't you his brother, you know, a couple weeks ago before this happened?
And the answer, of course, is yes. Now, I believe that the Democratic Party is too fast in doing this in terms of asking for resignations. And, you know, one of the things we talked about on this program on Mea Culpa going back like 40 plus episodes ago was the fact that I believe that Andrew Cuomo has the right to defend himself against the allegations, taking nothing away from the women who made the allegations, taking nothing away from our law enforcement agencies that did an investigation on these 11 allegations by these 11 women. If you recall, look how fast that they turned around and they told Schneiderman, who acknowledged that he was as guilty as fuck, and so he was going to take a fast walk. But look what they did to Al Franken. I use Al Franken as a perfect example. Resign, resign, resign. Everybody's so fast. Schumer, Pelosi, everybody's so fast. Personally, if I was Al Franken, I would have told them that they should resign. I'm not resigning. And I believe that Cuomo was right when he said, I want the facts to come out because the facts will exonerate me. Well, first of all, the facts did come out and they don't fucking exonerate him at all. Let's be just straight up about that one. And now that the facts are out, this is the time for him to do the right thing for the Democratic Party. But I really, truly dislike when they turn around and the first thing they say is, I think he should resign. He should. And that's prior to the information coming out. At this point, now that this 165-page report, which is damning as all hell, is out, one of the things that he should do is he should really analyze what's his likelihood of reelection, probably zero. What's his likelihood of impeachment, probably close to 100%. Yeah. And he should do the smart thing and resign. But I took offense and I take offense to this day that Al Franken walked away. I never would have done that because if you compare the two, what Al Franken did, a former comic thinking he's funny, everybody sometimes in their life does something stupid, apologize for it, move on. It's nothing like what was going on here, where you have employees working for you, where you're groping them, making sexual innuendos. It's just a total different animal. And if you compare the two, I would say Franken is at like a 1 out of 10, and Cuomo is like an 11.
You think Franken will make a comeback? He's back in New York, right? As I understand it, do you think he'll run for something? Because there, you're not alone in. I hear it constantly that Al Franken was railroaded. It's become a huge kind of a black mark for a lot of people on what they see as this like abuse of due process, or like skipping right through due process. And I wonder if you think that there's some political future for him in New York.
It's hard. I don't know the answer to that. It's a great question. I hope he does run for something. I always found him to be very competent and very straightforward. I also give him a lot of credit for doing what he did. He didn't want to create an issue for the Democratic Party, and he stepped aside. He put the party above himself. Now, let's compare that to the Republicans. I mean, Donald Trump should have been indicted and incarcerated on probably more than 15 different matters that I have provided testimony to 9 different federal agencies, not including the Attorney General's office, meaning Tish James's office, or Cy Vance's district attorney's office. And yet, Republicans keep saying, nope, Donald Trump, if today was the nomination, he would be nominated for the as the representative of the Republican Party. And if not Donald himself, than his idiot son, Don Jr., right? Most probably because of name recognition. I mean, kind of contrast the two of those together. What's your opinion on
that?
Yeah,
and he even cost the Republicans control of the Senate. I mean, Mitch McConnell deserves blame, too, for not, you know, just waving through the $2,000 checks. But if Trump had not been contesting the election all the way through January, I think there's no way that the Democrats win those two seats in Georgia and thereby take control of the Senate. So it is unprecedented in American history to have a one-term president who then also that alone is unprecedented, to have a one-term president who remains so powerful. Normally they become pariahs in the party. Like you can you imagine like Jimmy Carter trying to give the Democratic Party orders in like 1982? No, Jimmy Carter was done. And he went on and built houses for the next couple decades. But not only did he not only was he a one-term president, but then he cost the party this control of the United States Senate, and yet maintains a grip on the party. And it's he does it in the same way that Cuomo did, the fear. And so if that fear is ever broken, then he loses it, and then he loses that grip. But right now, this is still a party that's in fear of him.
Yep. And it's all about the fundraising. It's all about the Benjamins. You know, Ryan, I want to switch gears for a second now and discuss someone that you've been reporting on for quite some time. And that's Tom Barrack, right? If Tom flips on Trump, what, in your opinion, would be the most damaging to the former president based upon what you know of the case and about Tom Barrack?
Well, so there is, for people that didn't follow, Middle East policy much during the Trump administration, there is the potential of a crime of the century being committed there if all of the evidence could be pieced together. And essentially, and you might have some insight into how some of this unfolded as well. But essentially, the Kushners, made an awful decision in 2007, and spent something like $1.8 billion on 666, 666 Fifth Avenue.
666 yeah. Fifth Avenue, known as the worst real estate deal
ever
in the history of New York City.
Paid something ever. Like 2.5 times more than anybody had paid per square foot, like ever. So it was a horrible deal, a terrible idea on the day it was done. Everybody could already read the writing on the wall that the real estate market was cooling. And so then it completely collapses the next year. And so now the entire family's fortunes are swirling around the toilet. And Barrack, connected Trump at one point with Kushner and helped create some type of a bailout there. Barrack then connects the Kushners wasn't born in Lebanon, but his family comes from Lebanon. He has a lot of connections in the Middle East. He connects the Kushners with a lot of wealthy people in the Middle East. So then when Kushner becomes senior advisor to the president, this property is still on the brink of collapse. The loans are coming due. The entire family's future, is at risk. As we reported at The Intercept, Charles Kushner and the Kushner companies approached Qatar, the government of Qatar, and also approached this guy named Hamad bin Jassim bin Jaber Al Thani, who's one of the richest men in the world, the richest person in Qatar, former prime minister. Somebody said of him the leader of the country said, I run the country, but HBJ owns it. I think people call him HBJ. So, with a snap of his finger, he could bail out Kushner. They look into the deal and he's like, look, if you can find some other financing, somebody else to go in on this, then let's talk. If you remember, there was this scandal where, what was it, Kushner's sister or somebody in the Kushner family
was
in China trying to extract money from China to try to basically to get the matching funds so that they could bail this out. So that it all falls apart because the China thing gets exposed. Without the China thing, the Qataris are like, you know what? You know, this deal's not gonna fly. Charles Kushner approached the actual foreign minister, you know, not just a member of the royal family and the richest person in there. So this all falls apart, and Qatar says no. You know, we're not bailing this property out. Kushner then, you know, Kushner organizes as the first trip for Trump to the Middle East, his first trip anywhere in the world to be to Saudi Arabia. Huge, you know, setting a new precedent there that had never been done before. Everybody remembers that famous orb photo. The Kushner, Ivanka, and Jared met privately with Mohammed bin Salman there. We don't know exactly what was said there. Not long after there, Kushner traveled, you know, privately off the grid, met with him till like 4 a.m. And then what we know is that shortly after Qatar had said no, and shortly after this meeting between Kushner's and MBS and Trump going over there, UAE and Saudi Arabia declare a blockade of Qatar to the point where they were on the brink of invading the country. This is a country that has a military base with 10,000 U.S. troops. They're about to launch an invasion.
A U.S. military base.
U.S. military base.
The only one in the entire region.
And Kushner's friends are now blockading it and threatening an invasion. Tillerson gets wind of this and tries to end this quickly. Like this, we cannot have a blockade of our ally in the Middle East with our troops in the country. And the UAE and Saudi Arabia using Kushner back channel to Trump and cut Tillerson out of the process. We have reporting that shows that Tillerson was actually eventually fired over this, over his attempt to mediate this. And Trump takes the side of Saudi and the UAE against Qatar and says Qatar is harboring terrorists. In a matter of weeks from trying to, you know, shake them down for money to bail out your business to now saying that they're sheltering terrorists and therefore this blockade is justified. The blockade ends up going all the way through the Trump administration, and a Qatar linked investment vehicle eventually does bail out Kushner's firm. Now, Kushner's investments. Now, if anybody can prove that Kushner connected these issues, that Kushner used the might of U.S. foreign policy that put American troops in harm's way in order to pressure a business partner to pay up, that to me is a crime of the century. So if Barrick has information on that and would share it, that would be explosive. I am highly skeptical that he actually will. I think he'd rather go to jail than do that. But what do you think? I mean, do you think that this did unfold kind of the way that people think it unfolded, the way that I described it?
So let me start by saying this. Bravo. spot on. Literally spot on. I have not heard anybody, and I'm talking about, I speak to a lot of people on a regular basis, whether it's for this show, whether it's for television. I have never heard anybody lay it out so correctly. First of all, let me start with HBJ, who I used to call a friend of mine, and not because of Trump, and not through Trump, through another through a mutual friend who's very close to him. I was with HBJ having lunch in Florida, okay, when he told me the story that Charles Kushner came to him. And you are spot on in your reporting. Charles Kushner came to him to bail them out of this issue that they had on the upcoming loan at 666 Fifth Avenue.
Remember when that was?
And HBJ walked...
When you met with him?
Yeah, it was around... I know I have it because I have a photo of me, Trump, and HBJ at Mar-a-Lago. But I can tell you that you're, and I'll look it up and I'll text you on that one. But one of the things that he had said to me was that when Charles came to me, I turned around and I told him that you guys are way too hot. Meaning the sister had just gone to China. It was for EB-5s and was throwing around not only her brother, but Trump with pictures in China about how her brother's pushing for the EB-5s to come through. It was a nightmare for her, for the family, and it cost them the ability to do business with HBJ. Now, let me be very, straightforward when it comes to HBJ. He is one of the richest men in the world. All right. He was the creator of the Qatari Investment Authority. And yes, the president or the premier of Qatar is 100% correct. He runs it, but he finances it. He's incredibly astute. He's an amazing businessman. And there was nothing nefarious here by going to the richest man and one of the richest men in the world and asking him to bail you out on a real estate deal. I don't know what was promised, but based upon my understanding, the conversation didn't last long because the sister's actions in China really put HBJ, it was very uncomfortable mm-hmm. for him, and he respectfully declined. Traveling on summer vacation is a great way to disconnect, but sometimes you just need to connect to public Wi-Fi to take care of emails or post photos on social media. Unfortunately, cybercriminals can spy on unsecured public Wi-Fi networks to see your browsing history, read your emails, and even see your passwords. We do a lot more online these days. Your information is out there, exposed. Unfortunately, cybercriminals are always looking for ways to take that information. The all-in-one protection of Norton 360 with LifeLock makes it easy to have protection in the digital world. Device security helps block cyber criminals from stealing your personal information. VPN to help keep information you send over Wi-Fi safe. LifeLock Identity Theft Protection monitors your personal information and alerts you to potential threats. Now, no one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but if you have Norton 360 with LifeLock, you can opt into cyber safety. So sign up today and save 25% or more off your first year by going to Norton.com/Cohen. That's 25% off Norton 360 with LifeLock at Norton.com/Cohen. Now, one of the issues that my opinion that they have in terms of Tom Barrack is, do I think that he would flip on Trump? 100%. He is identical to Trump. He's identical to Cuomo. It's all the hubris, the ego, the narcissism. The world runs around them. Do I think he will flip? If that means keeping him out of jail and sending Kushner or Trump or somebody else to prison in his stead, 100%. But the bigger problem comes in, not so much as what he says, but what he says that can actually be used because, of course, what Trump or Kushner or the government may try to say is that this is classified material. Now, I have an issue with that as well, because I've seen reports from CNN, from CNBC, CNN, MSNBC, all of them talking about how Barrack's information could be deemed classified. And I'm wondering, why is it classified if he never worked for the U.S. government? And that whole Riyadh trip that you referenced is a real fucking thorn in my ass, because I asked a guy as I was raising money for the PIC, and Tom Barrack was the chair mm-hmm. of the Presidential Inaugural Committee. There's still like $80 million missing. They all went to throw Stephanie Winston Wolkoff under the bus. We're seeing videos and recordings between her, Melania, her and other people regarding this, and hopefully that information comes out. But one of the things that we're seeing is, how is it that this could be classified material if, in fact, that Tom never worked for the U.S. government? And going back to that Riyadh story that you brought up, I asked a guy who I had asked for $1 million for the pick, and he wrote me a check in 30 seconds on it, simply because he's not a fan of Donald's. But you know what? This is going to be the incoming president. He was going to support it. He also is a big hedge fund guy. And one of the interesting things was that he had called. This is after he had given $1 million, the inauguration took place, blah, blah, blah. His clients were already going to this Riyadh event. He just wanted to meet and to be able to be in the same locale as his clients that gave him several billion dollars for his hedge fund. So he calls up Jared and he calls up Tom and they say no. Why not? Why not? So he turns around and he calls me. He says, this is bullshit. I gave you $1 million because you asked. My clients are going there. I don't want to travel with the president. I don't want to go on Air Force One, even though he knows Donald for years. And Donald probably would have said yes under other circumstances. That means not having any involvement with Kushner or Barrack at the time. Trump would have put him on Air Force One. I don't want to travel with him in the motorcade. I have my own security. I have my own plane. I'm going to be there anyway. You know, can I go? And Jared returns my call and says he spoke to Tom and Tom said that it's too late and that unfortunately there are no more available tickets. Well, the guy went anyway because one of the members of the royal family who was this guy's client got him a ticket anyway. But I started putting two and two together. And here's what I believe. What was the purpose of that Riyadh trip?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
The stated purpose of it. Yeah.
The stated purpose.
I don't even remember what the stated purpose was.
Trump was going there to raise $250 billion for the U.S.
Infrastructure Fund. Yeah.
And then after that, he was going to go to China and raise $250 billion. And then after that, Japan. And then he came back and he did a whole presser. It's so easy. I just go there and they give me money and then I'm going to give it to Wall Street and they're going to put a 10-to-1 multiple on it. We're going to have $7.5 trillion to invest in our infrastructure and it's going to all be foreign money, blah, blah, blah. Right. And then once I heard him say that about putting it on Wall Street, it all became clear to me because I know all the players and I know just how seriously gross that they all are. The goal was to put that $250 billion into Tom Barrack's colony capital. Now, this is all my opinion, by the way, right? It sounds right. It's certainly plausible. And then another $250 billion from China and another $250 that colony capital, which then merged with North Star, became Colony North Star, right, was going to then have $750 billion under management, at which point everybody knew Kushner had no interest or intention of staying in Washington for 4 years. He would leave after 2 years. He would join Barrack as a partner in Colony North Star, or whatever the name of the firm would be at that time. You know how much $750 billion of management taking just a 1% fee comes out to be? You know, that's just to turn the lights on. 750 million divided by two or three people. That's a lot of money.
You can bail out a lot of bad
investments. Not to mention how much you get. It sure could. And how many years it would take to spend that $7.5 trillion, making them probably one of the largest, if not the largest hedge fund in the United States. All a great idea until one thing. Trump then puts out a Muslim ban, right? And the Arab Emirates, all of the Gulf Coast countries, they all turn around and say, you know, fuck this. You know, I'm not putting in any money. And the whole thing was a ruse anyway, because nobody intended on giving $250 billion.
Right. Right. Yeah. The commitments he came back with were kind of fake commitments that were just kind of re-upped offers that were already in the works, like things that they had already pledged before. They're like, they just kind of dressed them up in a new PowerPoint, said we're going to do this.
Exactly. And I have no idea why this is not under investigation. Even just using your information, this thing should be under investigation. Which brings me to my next question. Do you find the timing odd that Jared Kushner makes his public exit from politics just as Barrack is indicted? If you would, explain to my listeners, and you have a really great timeline onto this. Explain to my listeners how these two cross and what kind of exposure could be in store for Prince Jared, the secretary of everything.
For sure. And like, and I think you might have, I think somebody on Twitter said this, and I think it might have been, I might have even seen it on your feed, that he's not actually leaving politics. Like, well, you know, if he is continuing shuttling back and forth between the, you know, Middle East and New York and trying to, you know, shake money down from the royal families there. And, you know, it's there isn't a lot of kind of independent money over there. You know, if HBJ, you know, you're like you said, it's the sovereign wealth fund of Qatar that he controls. So it's not exactly like he's a private investor. So you are inherently involving yourself with the geopolitics of the region by continuing to try to cut these deals. And the only reason that you're able to do that is your connection to Trump and the possibility that Trump might come back to power. It's not, Kushner has shown that he's not a smart investment from a business perspective. Just from the fact that he's shortly after taking control of the company, almost blew it up, and then has spent the rest of the time trying to save it from drowning. So that's not the first place you'd go for an investment if your only return you were looking for was profit. But if you're involved in politics, then geopolitics, yeah, this is coin you pay. I interviewed one senior Qatari official around that time. And he said ruefully, you know, I wish we had just paid, because they suffered a lot from that blockade. Like, that was, you know, they survived, but it would have been much cheaper for them to have just anteed up, you know, paid the fee that was being asked of them. And so
you mean extorted, extorted them.
Yes.
And I do want to say this, because, like I said, your reporting on this is just spot on. But Kushner's relationship with the Qataris, with HBJ, that's not the strong Middle Eastern relationship.
Exactly.
Which we all know.
Right.
Right. And Saudi right. Arabia. It's his relationship to Mohammed bin Salman. And let's not forget that the Saudi investment authority, or what, the sovereign wealth fund, the Saudi sovereign wealth fund, that's pretty significant, mm-hmm. too.
Yes. You know? No. Exactly. And that's where he's really going for money. And one thing. So anyway, to your question, like, yeah, Barrack knows all these players. Barrack, you know, helped make a lot of these connections. Barrack would know a lot about, you know, what exactly Kushner was doing, because a lot of people have said that, you know, when Kushner was going over to the Middle East, meeting with UAE, meeting with Saudi. That generously, you could say that 50% of what he was doing was government, 50% was business. So if that's true, Barrack would know that. Barrack would have real insight into that. And we haven't even gotten to all of the human rights abuses that are linked with this. You know, shortly after Kushner leaves that Riyadh meeting, Mohammed bin Salman rounds up a whole bunch of elites in the Ritz, if you remember, in Riyadh, tortures some of them. One of them killed, you know, one of them was killed, and extracts something like $90 billion or, you know, some obscene amount of money, from these people in what he calls an anti-corruption push. Like, the idea that this happened without, you know, and we know for a fact that Trump approved of it. Trump tweeted immediately his approval of this action. Did Kushner approve of it beforehand? You know, were these people that were on the wrong end of a Kushner deal?
Ryan, do you remember after he made the announcement that this was an anti-corruption roundup of other members of the royal family? He went out, he bought a house for $500 million in London. He bought a yacht for $500 million, and he bought a piece of art for $500 million. Right. He spent $1.5 billion in an afternoon, which is a good thing that it's anti-corruption. But one of the mistakes that I also, and I've been talking about it quite a bit, that Kushner is making in terms of the royal family, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, and the other royal members. I know Saudis. I know many Saudis, some of whom are part of the royal family themselves. I've known them longer than I've known Trump. And I can tell you, you're only as valuable to them, right, as what you can offer them. Right now, Kushner can't mm-hmm. offer them shit. And so Mohammed bin Salman, who is wickedly smart, you know, I read his book also while I was there, you know, in prison, and so much of it is nonsense. But there's a lot of, if you could read between the lines, there's a lot of mm-hmm. info there. One of the crazy things is he is very similar in many respects to Trump. He will get out of you what he can. And the second you are of no longer value to him, he cuts you off. So Kushner could sit there, call, hey, Muhammad, how you doing? Kifek Habibi, right? Fuck you, right? Now, you're right. He may not say that to him because of fear that Donald could run again in 2024. The second that Donald is no longer around in 2024, and you could rest assured that the DA and Tish James are going to make sure of that with all of the indictments that are up, that are coming out soon. I can tell you, all right, Mohammed bin Salman will have no interaction with Kushner, and all of those secret meetings, probably, you're right, the only person that knows what went on in those secret meetings between MBS and Kushner is probably Tom Barrack, because this was always all about money. Now, Ryan, I particularly enjoyed this take on Kushner by Christopher Harrison that you posted, and I quote, he's not leaving politics. He's monetizing Trump's control over the GOP by collecting money, seeking to buy GOP Middle Eastern policy, and will probably be exempt from FARA. Now, conservatives say goodbye to an independent ME foreign policy goodbye. Hoping that you could do me a favor, just unpack a little more what Harrison is saying for my listeners and why it resonated with you so much.
Right. And he's a former senior aide to Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice, the, you know, high, you know, a high level GOP, old school GOP official who, you know, is, you know, foreign corruption is one of the biggest issues for him. And what his argument is that Washington just doesn't understand, or at least the public doesn't understand how thoroughly bought off Washington is by these big spending foreign operations. And the UAE and Saudi are chief among them, and, you know, funding hospitals. If the hospitals have connections to influential people, that's before you get to funding the think tanks that are produced, that are hiring the people, that's, you know, funding people to take trips, over to the region, create, you know, speaking gigs, fellowships. If you serve a couple years in the foreign policy apparatus in the United States, you actually now have a pretty easy path to a very comfortable life on the dime of somebody like the UAE or Saudi Arabia or other countries who will who will pay you handsomely to do very little. And so what that does is it affects what kind of decisions you're going to make, what kind of criticisms you'll make when you're in office. And so what Christopher Harrison is saying there is that, right, he's not remotely leaving politics. He's just profiting off of his connection to Trump, just like he has been. And that's, and we haven't even gotten to Jamal Khashoggi yet. I actually had lunch with Khashoggi about 3 weeks before he was chopped to pieces in Istanbul, because he wanted to start writing columns for the Intercept to supplement what he was doing for the Washington Post. He was only writing very infrequently for the Post. And so a mutual friend of ours texted me while he was still inside the consulate.
It was the consulate.
Right. So he was still inside there, and a mutual friend of ours texts and says, you know, I heard from his fiance. He's not out yet. I immediately texted Jared Kushner, because I had been, you know, I had texted with him to get comment for stories in the past. And I said, hey, I have heard that Jamal Khashoggi's in the consulate right now, Turkish police are surrounding it. He hasn't come out. It sounds like MBS might be trying to kidnap him. There are a couple other messages to that effect. He didn't reply to any of them. In the past, he had, you know, at least replied like a no comment or something. A few days later, I texted him again. I said, I'm now hearing credible reports from people in Turkey that he's been killed. And again, nothing. And so he can't say that he didn't know immediately that he was missing within an hour or so of him going into the consulate. Did he know before? I think it's really important to know, like, was he read in on this Mohammed bin Salman plan to use the use his brother, the Saudi ambassador, to lure Khashoggi into this consulate where he'd be killed. And, you know, is Mohammed bin Salman going to do that without the express permission of somebody like Kushner? Maybe. But did he have it? That's a very important question.
It sure is. And Ryan, one of the things we also know is right after the information broke that they were Saudi individuals back and forth with the royal family and people in the Saudi government, one of the things we know is the very first and only call that Mohammed bin Salman agreed to make and to talk about this issue at all was with Jared Kushner. And so I don't know whether or not the sum and substance of that conversation has ever been released, but that would be a hell of a story. That would be a whopper, right? I mean, and I have to tell you, I read also the book while I was in prison, Killing in the Consulate, an absolute riveting book. And what I, you know, for me, it was a little bit more personal because one of my friends from the early 80s happens to be the cousin of Jamal Khashoggi. Mm. So I took it, you know, obviously very personal, as did she. I'm curious if you saw the New Yorker piece by Jane Mayer. We had her on the show, by the way, about the big money fueling the big lie that's paying for all of the recounts in Arizona and elsewhere. Personally, I found this quote the most chilling from an election expert, and I quote, "The Maricopa County audit exposes exactly what the big lie is all about. If they come up with an analysis that discredits the 2020 election results in Arizona, it will be replicated in other states, furthering more chaos that will enable new legislation. Millions of Americans could be disenfranchised, helping Donald Trump to be elected again in 2024. That's the bottom line. Maricopa County is the prism through which to view everything." Now, I wasn't aware until reading this piece of the array of dark money that's pushing these lies. Can you discuss this with me?
Sure, sure. And I think the game being played here is twofold. One, you create a narrative that allows people to believe that fraud is the reason that Joe Biden won this election, then it creates the justification for tons of voter suppression laws, and not just voter suppression laws, voter disqualification laws. They're finding ways that even if somebody does manage to vote, if they're in the wrong precinct, you can no longer do provisional ballots. You know, trying to not just trying to keep people at home, but trying to throw out the votes of people who did come out to vote, and also reforming the architecture of our election system so that partisan actors have much more control over the counting of the votes and the determining of the winner than currently exists. And so part A is already well underway. I think part B is creating a culture that allows Republicans to say, you know what? We don't believe in fraud. We don't believe in stealing elections, but the last election was stolen from us. Therefore, we're justified in stealing this next election. And I think the reason that Trump failed is because the norms around democracy in this country still remain surprisingly strong. You know, even some Trump appointed judges around the country, you know, we're looking at the evidence being put forward by this clown show of a legal team, and they were rejecting it. And that was because there is still a reverence in kind of the American heart for the sanctity of democracy. And what Republicans are trying to do with things like this Maricopa County audit is rip that heart out and to say that, no, there's nothing sacred about our democracy. It's been corrupted by Democrats and by Joe Biden. And so therefore, we are entirely within our rights, and not just within our rights, it's our moral obligation to do everything we can to steal the next election. They wouldn't say steal the election, but they would say, you know, make sure by whatever means necessary that Democrats can't steal it. And when you as Republicans define Democrats stealing an election as Democrats winning an election. Like, they don't believe that Democrats can legitimately win an election. Then anything that Republicans do to win the election is therefore justified. And there was a great quote. I don't remember who said it. They said something like, well, I mean, if you take out Philadelphia, Trump won Pennsylvania easily. And that really, that sounds absurd. It's like, how do you take Philadelphia out of Pennsylvania? What are you talking about? Like, it's, you can't take Philadelphia out of Pennsylvania. But what it reveals is this mindset that some votes count and some votes shouldn't count.
Well, right. For Donald Trump, it was only the votes that were for him.
Right.
He wanted to count. But, you know, I just wanted to say that it failed, not so much for the reasons that you were enumerating, but really failed because the people that were around Trump, right, were incompetent. Hmm. They came up with a game plan on how to destroy our democracy, how to basically, you know, Trump used to always say this quote, and I remember discussing this quote with him, and it was a Putin quote. That doesn't matter who you vote for. All that matters is who's counting the votes. Right? I mean, think about that. It doesn't matter who you vote for. All that matters is who's counting the votes. And that was Donald Trump's ideology. And what makes this so scary for America is the fact that Donald's an idiot. This we all acknowledge. He's got the vocabulary of a 4-year-old. You know, he has the attention span of a 2-year-old. The big problem is what happens when you get the next guy, the Donald Trump 2.0, who's smarter than him and more sinister and puts together a real team, not the fucking Corey Lewandowski's for $5,000 a week, you know, as a campaign manager, less than what you would pay your Uber driver, right, to take you around. I mean, that's what Donald was all about. You know, it's paying zero and getting basically what you pay for. But I'm talking about somebody that's willing to spend the money, a real billionaire that is as sinister, if not more, than Trump. That's the problem. Now, Ryan, a question that I've been asking some of my guests recently, and I would really love your take on it, is around the almost criminal negligence going on with some of these red state governments and these governors and their managing of COVID-19. Now, for example, you have Ron DeSantis, as the example, unwilling to declare a state of emergencies and hospitals running out of fucking oxygen and intensive care units filled with children. Right. Elsewhere, there's the prospect of real mass death and suffering for the unvaccinated. My question to you is, at what point does the negligence become criminal, where the federal government has to intervene on a state level and force them to comply?
Gee, that's a good question. I feel like DeSantis in particular is just hoping that, like happened in the UK, and I think like happened in India to some respect, in South Africa to some respect, that the Delta created this horrific situation that and then burned out really quickly. And so what you do is you end up throwing thousands of bodies on the pyre, but then the fire just burns out. It's horrifyingly immoral calculation, but I feel like that's the one that's being made right now, that let's just cross our fingers and hope that this Delta thing whips through pretty fast, which is basically the same calculation that Trump was making in March 2020. Don't worry,
Mike Pence.
Yeah,
and Mike Pence.
This will burn itself out, which we've seen how that, you know, here we are a year and a half later and it's not burned out.
With 620,000 Americans lost and continuing, right, as a direct result of his bungling of this pandemic. You know what I find interesting about this whole pandemic, this whole coronavirus argument, is the fact that Donald Trump, in his mind, truly believes that he's entitled to the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in Operation Warp Speed. Now, we have to give him credit. They did come up with the vaccine in a very, very, very quick time period. And so I will give him all the props for that. The problem, though, is that he had no program within which to, you know, put it into the arms of the, you know, the American people. So that's great. You have the vaccine, but there's no plan within which to administer it. So it's a really big problem if you think about it. And not only did he say that stupid shit, oh, it's only one person, right? It's like the flu. People die from the flu, right? He thought he was going to bullshit the virus away. And we obviously know that that's not happening. And, you know, we are much more populated in a smaller, you know, square footage basis than in other countries. And so that's why we're seeing these sort of horrific numbers. It's really, it's absolutely crazy. And I reject the notion that it's the Wuhan flu, that it's the China virus. This is the Trump virus. And he's responsible, in my opinion, for all of the deaths as a result of it. And the blood of these people, you know, is on him and his soul. And that's just how I feel about it. But Ryan, I told you the hour goes by really fast. So I have basically one last question for you. It's another kind of doozy. So my last question is a broad question about Donald Trump and the so-called memo gate. Now, we have in his orders, which were noted by witnesses, evidence of a crime. Why has there not been more aggressive action taken here? Right? Is it coming, or does Merrick Garland not have the political will to take on Trump and the Republicans? Can we expect any justice? Can we expect any justice on January 6th from this and the election, or is this all just a big nothing?
And which particular memo do you mean by Memogate?
Yeah, I'm talking about like the January 6th insurrection,
right.
As well as some of these other memos that came out post,
right.
You know, the impeachment.
If I had to prognosticate, and knowing our political system, I would think that he's more likely to get caught up in some type of corporate crime. That, you know, we are just very reluctant to prosecute people for, you know, to prosecute politicians for when they overstep. I mean, you have a better insight into which, you know, what other federal crimes, you know, he has committed and could be found guilty of. If I wrote a piece a while ago, like, that went through the actual code, and we, like, I and some researchers were able to pretty quickly identify half a dozen to a dozen just from public things that he'd done in public. But yeah, I don't think Merrick Garland is the man for this hour in that sense. Like, I don't think that this is remotely like taking on a former president is remotely a job that he ever was interested in. He's just kind of a,
well, too bad. Know,
but it's the,
by the way,
it's a job.
Too bad. You took the job, do the job. And I call on Joe Biden on a regular basis. I call on Kamala Harris on a regular basis. I call on Merrick Garland, Lisa Monaco, step up and do what you need to do. You know, the American people are entitled, right, to know that democracy exists, that the Democrats ran, right? We ran on the notion that no one is above the law. Well, not according to my question to you. It appears that if you are a politician and you do shady shit like what they did in the Middle East, like what he did, you know, in the January 6th insurrection and in a dozen other specific examples, that we are a country of law with no justice, because you're too big, you're too powerful to be. What? To put on the stand? Only the little fucks like me, right, who paid for the guy to get his pecker pulled by a porn star, should go to prison? Despite the fact that he was what? That he was a co-conspirator? It was done not only for his benefit, but at his direction, which is captured in an audio tape that was released? Seriously?
Yeah.
That's on me, and everybody else gets to walk? Why? Explain that. Why?
There's only one way to explain it, and it's what you said, that it's a nation of laws without justice for people at a particular level. That we, you know, when I was born in the 70s, right, you know, not long after the Nixon impeachment, and we were all in that era raised on the idea that Nixon showed that nobody's above the law, not even the president. That ignored the fact that he had gotten a pardon, but it was something that we all believed. And there's no way to square the example you give is as absurd and revealing as any could possibly be. Like, you have two people involved in a crime. One of them directed it. One of them benefited from it. The other is just involved. And the one who's involved is the one who pays for it. The only explanation is that the other one was too big to fail, too big to jail.
Right. And he controlled the entire process, which is improper. I mean, that's just another whole issue about Bill Barr and, you know, all of that other nonsense. And so it's just, to me, it's just crazy.
Yep. Yep. No other word for it.
Listen, I want to thank you so much for your time. I want to thank you for your insight. Your reporting, by the way, is spot on as it relates to what's going on with Barrick, with Kushner, with the Middle East, with all of your investigations. So really, truly kudos to you. And hopefully I'll have you back on here down the road as more unfolds with the Barrick scandal, because it's real. It's there. And it implicates everybody.
It really does. It really does. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being on.
And now for today's mea culpa. In thinking about Andrew Cuomo, I find myself meditating on the nature of power and how it ultimately corrupts the individual. Or in this case, how the projection of power opens the door for authoritarianism. In Cuomo, the left saw what it believed to be the perfect counterpoint to Donald Trump. In reality, it was a funhouse mirror reflection of the man staring back. In a sense, Cuomo was our own authoritarian dream. We gravitated toward him at our most vulnerable and frightened hours because we needed somebody, anybody, to tell us what to fucking do. And that's how easy it is to fall prey to this kind of cult of personality. Cast off your suspicions and let down your guard. Pretty soon, you have become what it is that you used to fear. But to those MAGA hordes whose own brains are twisted, we are the COVID virus, our politics and cultural vomit is more dangerous to them than any pandemic. They want it to stop, and Trump or the MAGA ideology is their bulwark. It's not an apples to apples comparison, but I'm showing you how easy it is to fall prey to someone else's bullshit. Not me, you say. Well, if you bought yourself a t-shirt with Cuomo's name or found yourself mooning over the governor on social media, then you are guilty as charged. It doesn't make you a bad person, it makes you human. But it should also make you realize how easy it is to fall sway. Henry Kissinger once remarked that power was the ultimate aphrodisiac. The question is, who or what comes next, and how much damage will they do to something so close to its breaking point? I don't know, but one thing I do know is thanks for listening. Mea Culpa is brought to you by Audio Up, Midas Touch, and LSJ Media, and it's written and produced by Jimmy Jelinek. Executive producers are Jared Gustat, Jimmy Jelinek, myself, Michael Cohen, and Phil Alberstadt. Our editor is Lisa Orkin. It may be a new day politically, but nowadays the landscape is more confusing than ever. Donald Trump may have lost the battle for the presidency, but in many ways, Trumpism is winning the war on the state and local level. Mea Culpa is here to help guide you through the wilderness and keep you informed. And let's face it, we all want Trump, Rudy, and the rest of these seditious traitors to see justice. And folks, it's coming. So stay tuned as I guide you through the twists and turns of the criminal process that will ultimately see them behind bars. Mea Culpa. Nothing but the truth.
Pluto TV is playing the biggest movies every night this summer, for free. Watch hit movies like The Matrix, G.I. Joe Retaliation, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Scary Movie, Runaway Bride, and more all summer long. Check out the biggest stars like The Rock, Keanu Reeves, Tom Cruise, Julia Roberts, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and more. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of free TV channels in English and Spanish featuring TV shows, news, sports, comedy, and more, all for free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device, including Android and Apple smartphones. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free. This is my man.